Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, August 24th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape. Steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. It's one of our famed vacation shows. I know. Are you going on vacation again? Yes, things got messed up. COVID. And what about the Republican convention? We'll talk about that in a moment. Just take it easy. Everybody, calm down. On the program today, however, a pre-recorded interview I did with, frankly, one of my favorite guests over the years, the chair and a professor, of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University, author Eddie Gloud, on his latest book, Begin Again, James Baldwin's America, and his urgent lessons for our own. Also on the program today, well, I don't know. We're going to be doing maybe a special members stuff. I'm not sure. That Matt and Brendan will have to work that out. Hopefully there'll be something in a couple of these days. But we're doing our best. Now, I know what you're thinking. My gosh, Sam, what are you thinking? The RNC starts tonight and you're off on vacation. This is a long time scheduled vacation with a parent of mine. And, you know, these are difficult times. And, you know, I'm in that, what do they call it? The sandwich or the two pieces of bread or something to that effect, where I got the little kids and I got, you know, parents who are getting a little bit older and dealing with certain issues and whatnot. And so immovable situation. However, I'm going to do my best to live stream some of this because this is going to be a crap show. And I'm saying this last week. So it's not even today for me when I make this assessment, but I'm this clairvoyant that I know it's going to be a crap show tonight. Now, first off, let me just say this. Nomi is doing her show at 3 p.m. today. You can go to patreon.com/the Nomi Key Show or go to youtube.com/the Nomi Key Show. And she had amazing panels and whatnot and great guests. You obviously saw Friday's show, I hope. I'm anticipating. So in other words, I know today is actually for me last week. And I am anticipating the guests that she had on Friday, which I know were great, but you know, who knows? Somebody maybe drop out or something. So I don't want to reference back to that. But believe me, if you didn't see Friday's show, go see it. And I say that from the past into the future. So we're crossing the time-space continuum here, and it's pretty crazy. But the Republican National Convention, I think it's going to be this sort of like bizarre mishmash of culture warriors. I imagine there will be someone who has had been a victim of crime from an immigrant. My understanding is he's also contemplating having Alice Johnson. That is the woman that he granted clemency to. I mean, good for him. He was spurred on by Kim Kardashian or Kim Kardashian West. I mean, to be honest with you, on it, like, I know this sounds ridiculous, but if Kim Kardashian was sitting here in this room with me, aside from me going like, what is she doing here? What is this person here? I wouldn't know who it was. Like, if she was standing in front of me, I wouldn't know who it was. I mean, if someone said that's Kim Kardashian, I vaguely know she was the daughter of that lawyer. They're also going to have the that Missouri couple who in St. Louis, who I was in St. Louis, maybe they came out. Patricia and Mark McCloskey, they came out with their guns to meet the BLM people. There's going to be anti-abortion advocates, of course, and there's going to be that Covington Catholic High School kid, Nicholas Sandman, who, you know, was just being like a kid, sticking his face into this elderly Native American's face just to show how he could just, I don't know, be a jerk or something. But and there's going to be more. And then, I think Scott Baio is going to be there. So it's going to be nuts. Nomi is doing a show every day at 3 p.m. And you can check that out. And both like as a precursor and a wrap up of the RNC. And if I go live on YouTube to because it's just too crazy or, I will put out a notice on the app. So if you want to go get the app, it's free, majorityapp.com. Allow for notifications. The most notifications we send on any given day is usually just one, and it's to tell you that the show, what's on the show that day. The AMQ. We also do a notification when the AM Quickie comes up, which you should also be checking out. That's going to happen all this week. Lucy Steiner is going to voice it. Corey and Jack are going to write it. So it's all happening this week, folks. And I'm going to come back. I'm going to be refreshed. And I'll be honest with you, too, about the RNC. In normal times, we would be in the studio. It would be fun to do. And even in COVID times, it's something that I would imagine that we would have done on Zoom. But shows like that, to a certain extent, I got to be honest with you, I associate still very much with Michael being around and, part of it just sort of laughing at this stuff and having fun. And, with every day, it gets a little bit easier, but it's a little bit awkward. So, but that's that. This interview is going to be, you're going to enjoy it. Eddie Gloud is a brilliant guy. And James Baldwin it's a fascinating perspective on James Baldwin, who's getting really big now, is my understanding. He's really getting, a lot of people are mentioning him. First, a couple of words from two of our sponsors. One is, and I've said this many times, hiring is challenging. Particularly in this environment, you don't want to be just, casting your net willy-nilly. You want it to be effective. You want it to be simple. You want it to be fast. You want it to be smart. There's a place where businesses can connect to qualified candidates, and that place is ZipRecruiter.com/majority. I've talked about ZipRecruiter many times on this program. I have used it. Brendan came via ZipRecruiter. There was a bunch of other candidates who were very strong. Brendan was just, was literally, if you took Brendan and put him into if you wanted to go into a laboratory and create somebody for the show with the same skill sets and sensibility, you would have created Brendan. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job sites, but they don't stop there. And this is what happened with Brendan. They have powerful matching technology. ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes. They find people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. That's what happened with Brendan. ZipRecruiter makes the entire hiring process efficient and effective. It's got features like you can screen questions to filter candidates. You can do an all-in-one dashboard where you can review and rate your candidates. So you can do like, oh, I need, these are the ones I need to check out, or this is the status I have with these. They're, you know, coming in for interviews, et cetera, et cetera. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Now, I've told you this, the best time to look for new hires is when you don't need one. Right now, try ZipRecruiter for free. My listeners can go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. MAJORITY. That's how you spell majority. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, it is literally the smartest way to hire. I don't know why I say literally all the time now, because my kids say that. They literally say it all the time. Oh, and the other thing that my kids say, specifically my 15-year-old daughter, Dad, what are you doing now? And I'm like, what are you talking about? And she's like, you're dressing better. And I'm not going to say, well, you know, you come out of a marriage, you know, and it's been a couple of years, but still, you want to put your best foot forward. I'm not always doing that, but she's like, where are you getting the ideas for your clothes? Sometimes she tells me, but I also have a little bit of a secret, and that secret is Stitch Fix. Now, this is a personal styling company. It makes getting the clothes that you love effortless. I know you buy online. Sometimes you're not sure about sizes. You have to return things, et cetera, et cetera. This is a completely different way to shop. It's all about you every time. What you do is, to get started, you go to stitchfix.com/majority. You set up your profile. They ask you questions like, what are your favorite colors? What are the style of clothes you wear? What are the brands that you wear? For me, I can only answer like a certain percentage of these questions because I'm just not that sophisticated about clothes. But I'll tell you what, they've nailed it. You pay $20 styling fee for each fix, which is like basically a box of stuff that they send you. But it's credited towards anything you end up keeping. You can schedule it anytime. There's no subscription required. The shipping, the returns, the exchanges, they're free and they're easy. Stitch Fix does all the hard work for you. It makes great styles effortless for everybody, including men, including women, including kids. For me, I've talked about this. I got my Nashville 5-pocket straight fit pant. I got my chukas. I don't know how to say it. But they're nice looking, like adult looking, but hip shoes. Not too hip, but just enough. And my daughter made way with my flannel shirt. So, but it was a great experience for me. I generally, you know, get hives when I've got to go shopping for clothes. This makes it much easier. So look, you can get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. You'll get 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. That's Stitch Fix. .com/majority for 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. Stitchfix.com/majority. As always, we will put all our links in the podcast and YouTube description. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Professor Eddie Gloud, on his book, Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and His Urgent Lessons for Our Own. Right back after this. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the James S. McDonnell Distinguished University Professor and Chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University, Eddie S. Gloud, Jr., on his book, Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lesson for Our Own. Eddie, welcome back to the program.
It's always a pleasure to dialogue with you, Sam. How many years has it been? My goodness.
This iteration of the program has its birthday, a 10-year anniversary on Election Day, but we spoke back in the Air America days. So it is, it's, I, at the very least, I know that I'm getting old. But it is always a pleasure to have you on, this has been an enormous success for you, and it's a wonderful achievement. I want to start you know, we spoke quite a bit around the time in the run up in like the post Obama years, in the run up to the Donald Trump election. You had written a book, Democracy in Black, which I thought was an incredible work, frankly, that captured all of the sort of the frustration and the maybe the lost promise, or maybe that it wasn't a promise of the Obama years. And in some ways, I mean, I'm curious, like, what was it that drew you to James Baldwin in the wake of the Trump election, and maybe in the wake of the Obama years?
You know, I love that phrase, in the wake of, you know, to echo Christina Sharpe's work, because in some ways I was dealing with my own despair and disillusionment, Sam. You know, I had written Democracy in Black, kind of an assessment of the Obama years, and screaming at the top of my lungs about what was happening in Black America as a result of the Great Recession, that, you know, all the gains of the 90s had been wiped out, that these young folk were risking their lives in the streets for a reason, and policing wasn't really changing. And, you know, even Occupy Wall Street calling our attention to the fundamental evil that's at the heart of an economic system that views people as disposable, and you have other folks who are extracting resources repeatedly from communities that are already resource deprived. And so I was trying my best in 2015 and 16 to open up space for a much more radical politics, at least to do it at the level of my writing. And then the country vomited up Donald Trump. And I had to figure out, right, what this meant. So I started looking for resources. And I was at the time thinking about writing a biography, intellectual biography of James Baldwin, and I was running into this brick wall. And then finally I just said, you know, Jimmy had to deal with this in his time, after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., after the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980. He had to deal with the country's betrayal again, and here we are. So I started reading him, and reading the late Baldwin, and the book just came into view after that.
I mean, it's fascinating because there is like this quality. I mean, there's so much of this experience that, I mean, and frankly, a lot of what you have written, like the concept of the value gap that you wrote about in Democracy in Black, has been a really important conceptual frame for me, both in terms of, you know, my work here, I guess, but also just as a person. And in some ways, you revisit that in this and now it's become almost the lie. There's a little nuance there, but it is the lie on some level, and there's a quality to all of this that I guess is embedded in James Baldwin, and I have to concede, I think I may have read Another Country when I was too young, frankly, to appreciate it, and I stayed away from Baldwin for a long time. I think I picked it up like when I was 12 or 13 and saw it and just read it, and I was like, I'm not ready for this. But the idea of like where the value gap, it mixes with the lie that we have been told about that gap. It's almost, there's almost a quality to this whole experience of what you've written here of, you know, the only thing I can imagine is it's, you know, you see a pillar of society, and yet you, as maybe that person's child or that person's victim, you know what is really behind the public face. And there's this quality there that where the value gap, talk to that sort of dynamic between what you call the value gap and the lie.
Yeah. So, you know, the value gap is this belief that white people matter more than others. And this belief evidences itself in our habits, right? How we come to understand ourselves. It evidences itself in our social, political, and economic arrangements. So, you know, I've been saying over and over again, Sam, that, you know, it's one thing to take down the monuments to the Confederacy. It's another thing to take down or to transform the highway system of, in Chicago, right? Both of them are monuments to an ideology, right, that reflect the value gap in specific sorts of ways. And so the lie is an extension. The lie is what is what I describe as the kind of architecture surrounding the value gap. It's what gives it not necessarily life, because habits give it life in our dispositions. But the lie is what sustains it in some ways, right? So we tell ourselves a story that obscures how we're valuing and devaluing people. And, you know, there's this moment that Baldwin writes about in 1964 in his essay, The White Problem. And he says, if you don't mind me reading it, he says, "The people who settled the country had a fatal flaw. They could recognize a man when they saw one. They knew he wasn't anything else but a man. But since they were Christian and since they had already decided that they came here to establish a free country, the only way to justify the role this chattel was playing in one's life was to say that he was not a man. For if he wasn't, then no crime had been committed. That lie is the basis of our present trouble." So not only do we tell a lie about what we've done, we tell a lie about these people's capacities and their passions. We tell a lie about them, so they're not accorded dignity and standing. They're dehumanized, right? And that is the way in which the value gap takes root, you see. And then we tell a lie about our own self, that's about the country, about us being the shining city on the hill, as Reagan put it, you know, recasting John Winthrop's model of Christian charity speech. We're the shining city on the hill. We're the Redeemer Nation, example of democracy achieved. When we're doing all of this, you know, this work, this devastation, exacting this devastation across the globe, right? I mean, like, as if Nagasaki and Hiroshima didn't happen, as if what we've done in Haiti or Cuba or the Philippines or in Africa hasn't happened, right? So we tell our story that we're always an instrument of good, and then we tell lies to malform the truth about what we've done, right? So it's very difficult to break through, because we're so wedded to this idea that America is inherently good. That's what I mean by the lie. That's why I think these two books should be read together. But that's just in my head.
Well, no, I agree. These concepts are they're joined, and in many respects, the lie is almost the grease, the thing that sort of makes that ability to have a value gap in our everyday practice. It provides almost the grease. It makes it frictionless in some ways.
Right.
And
exactly.
In many respects, what we're seeing with movements like Black Lives Matter and it's creating friction. And in many respects, like, these video cameras have created the friction that make it harder to sustain this lie.
Yeah, you know, so we have to stick our heads in the sand, right? Or we have to declare that we are more committed to the lie than we are to the truth. Or we have to finally face what we've done and change. But see, oftentimes when we do that, Sam, you know, we clutch our pearls and we say, "Oh my God, is this America?" And, you know, and then some of us will say, "Well, where have you been? Of course this is America." And then folks say, "Well, what can I do to change? What can I do to change, help change this?" And oftentimes that question reveals a philanthropic model, right? A philanthropic right. Understanding of racial justice, as if it's something that we can do, like we can give to Goodwill or Salvation Army or something, and then we can go back to our lives, right? And what you get in these moments is America tinkering around the edges and then congratulating itself and expecting gratitude from us.
Well, that is, I mean, that I think your example of pulling down a Confederate statue and pulling down a highway that may function to segregate or may split apart a community is really apt there, because we're not, it feels to me that we're not anywhere close to getting towards the infrastructure of these things. We're simply getting towards the, you know, these sort of like symbolic manifestations, which I guess, I mean, does that have to be sequential? Or, I mean, do we need to first get rid of those monuments, and then how do we get to the highways? How do we get to the infrastructure? Yeah. How do we get to the schools? How do we get to, I mean, all of these sort of like literally, you know, built in structures yeah. that are not just amenities and for show, but actually dictate where we travel throughout our day?
You know, that's a great question, and it is sequential. And I get this in some ways from Brian Stevenson, right? When he talks about truth and reconciliation, right? That they are sequential. That you first you have to tell the truth before there's reconciliation, and before there's repair, there has to be reconciliation, right? So it's truth, reconciliation, and repair. So the first thing we have to do is tell the truth about what we've done and who we are, and who we aspire to be. And that means challenging the lie whenever it's asserted, whenever it blinds us and blocks us to becoming otherwise. So that's the first thing we have to do. And then we have to engage in reconciliation. And what that will look like, it could look like H.R. 40. It could look like the legislation that Barbara Lee has just put forward. But then we have to engage in repair. And what repair will look like, it follows along the lines of policy, right? It will involve taking down these Confederate statues, which are monuments to lies, by the way. The Lost Cause is a lie. It's not true. It's a lie. So it involves taking down Confederate monuments. It involves really kind of dealing with the symbolic landscape of the country. And it also involves confronting what we do at the level of policy to reproduce a racially unjust society. How has the value gap shaped the distribution of advantage and disadvantage? Will it involve baby bonds? Will it involve a fundamental investment in public education? That because we've never invested ourselves in educating all of our children, and we need to understand what school vouchers actually means. We need to understand what private schools, many of them are dated around 1955, and why that's the case, right? We need to tell ourselves the truth so that then we can bring the whole the resources of the richest nation in the history of the world to repair so that we can be otherwise. Now, that's going to be hard work. It's not easy. But what I do know is that we cannot reach for safety. We cannot reach for comfort in this moment, or we will double down on our ugliness again, and another generation will have to go through this shit, Sam.
So,
excuse my language.
Well, I understand. So, okay, with that said, and when we were leading into the 2016 election, you were writing in Democracy in Black. You know, you were to some extent, and I think, you know, and I know that you and I, we were talking about this as a dilemma, which was, in fact, settling for a half measure. Or the comfort of returning, you know, what we now describe as returning to pre-Trump, as it were. You know, at the time, you were expressing the deep dissatisfaction with that status, and you were saying, you know, that I know that you were wrestling with the idea of saying that that Black people in particular should sit this one out. And basically say, like, you know, we're not going to sign up for more of the same. And now here we are with Joe Biden, who is, you know, knock on wood, hopefully things can change. But the fact is, he's selling like, hey, I'm going to give you more of what was before Donald Trump. And now you're really going to appreciate it. I mean, that's more or less his pitch, and a lot of people bought it, you know. And so, like, what do we do with that? I mean, like, you know, because I mean, hope springs eternal, but he's basically saying, you know, hey, what Hillary Clinton was offering, I'm offering. And the only thing that's changed is now maybe you'll appreciate it more. I mean, on some level, that is the subtext of what's going on here.
You know, I think that's a really apt description. And, you know, in Democracy in Black, I was calling for the blank out campaign. I wanted Black folk to turn out in massive numbers. I wanted organizers to push us to really think about the importance of down ballot voting and without Obama on the ticket, because I thought that for 8 years we had muted the issue of race outside of Black Lives Matter. We couldn't really hail the state in an appropriate way because Obama couldn't be seen as the Black president, right? He had to be seen as the president of all America, which in some ways made Black America a captured electorate. And so, you know, I thought we had an opportunity initially with Jeb Bush and Clinton running against each other that we could push the party to the left, that we could actually begin to break the back of Clintonism. And then when the Republican Party had nominated Donald Trump, I was like, oh, for sure, we could really push this now, because white America, there's no way white America is going to elect Donald Trump. That's what I was thinking in my head. How could they elect someone so clearly unqualified to be the leader of this country and the leader of the quote unquote free world, right? I was so wrong. It was an egregious error, the more I think about it. And you know, I write about this in Begin Again because I say that, you know, Baldwin faced a similar dilemma in 1979.
With Reagan, yes.
Reagan-Carter election. Carter had been seen, you know, Carter is in some ways the first neoliberal president in the country. Policies of austerity that devastated urban centers, devastated Black communities. And the Black leadership class actually said that he had betrayed them. And in some ways, Carter loses to Reagan because Black voter turnout was suppressed, right? Was it not as high as it was, right, in that elected him to office, you know? So, but Baldwin said, you know, Black folk, you know, sacrificed for the right to vote and then realized we didn't have much to vote for. So oftentimes Black people vote just to buy themselves some time. And as a lifelong reader of Baldwin, I should have known that. But I overestimated white America. Now, here we are. That's a long-winded preface to answer your question about now. We have to do two things simultaneously, it seems to me. We have to get Donald Trump out of office because I don't think the country can survive another 4 years of this guy. And I don't mean at the level of symbol. I'm talking about at the level of democratic institutions. He's not only eroding democratic norms, the institutions are faltering. And that's like, you know, I'm a country boy from Mississippi, Sam. That's like knowing you got termites in your floor and thinking you can go another year without treating them.
Right.
Eventually, the floor is just going to be so rotten, you got to pull all the boards up. So we got to get him out of office. That's clear to me. But we also have to push the Democratic Party. We have to push the Biden campaign. I mean, it makes no sense to me, right, that we're not having an argument. I understand why we're not, because of worries about Trump, that we're not having an argument that the pandemic has proven that tethering one's health care to one's employment makes no damn sense. Right? That this is not, we can't tinker around the edges, that a living wage makes no sense, that the country is choosing this despair and devastation. We didn't make the decision that Germany made. That's why we have over 40 plus million people unemployed. That's why we have folk who are losing their health care. So part of what we have to do is both and. We have to get Trump out of office, and we have to break the corporatist hold on the Democratic Party. That's hard to do when people are worried that making the latter argument would jeopardize the former aim.
Right.
But we have to make it anyway.
Give me a sense of your critique of capital and how it relates to racism. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things, I mean, I'm struck by a couple of things. Like one, you know, I came of age. I was in college when Reagan won his second term. And that's when I became, you know, I knew I didn't like Reagan, and I knew where I was politically, but I wasn't that engaged. And I also think that Reagan pulled the country so far to the right that, you know, what constituted growing up with a perspective of leftism, of liberalism, whatever you want to call it at that time, wasn't particularly that far left. And we're in a different era. I think, younger folk are much more sophisticated in their critique of capital and its relationship to race. What give me your sense of that? I mean, I know, because I've always, there weren't a lot of critics, frankly. I mean, there were some of Obama, both, some from a racial perspective and some from a, and I mean, on the left, from a perspective right. of what he had failed to do in terms of race, and in terms of what he had failed to do in terms of any type of economic populism, and some national security as well. But there wasn't that many, and you were one of them. But like, where do you think we are in terms of the sort of more sophisticated critiques of capital and its right. relationship to race?
Well, first of all, I think that there is a growing consensus around this view, that is, that capitalism, American capitalism as such, or that America as such, is broken, right? When we begin to see the levels of wealth inequality, when we see the precarity of everyday workers, they're busting their behinds trying to make ends meet and can barely keep their noses above water. As we've shifted since the last 40, 50 years, we've shifted emphases from stakeholders to shareholders. We've devastated possibilities of organizing with workers. And we've done so by really deepening the idea that certain people are disposable, right? So capitalism has its beginnings in some ways, in my mind, right, with the trafficking in black bodies, right? Racial capitalism has always been a critical feature of the way in which capital circulates. I mean, listen, black women's wombs were sites of capital accumulation in this country, right? And so there's this idea, right, that some people are disposable, and to the extent to which that's true, people can seek surplus value and profit based on the idea that some people can just be thrown away. Right now, I believe in markets. I don't believe in a command economy. Right. I don't necessarily hold to the view that government should control everything. But I do believe that everyday ordinary workers should have a say so. Right. In the nature of their work, that in the nature of the companies give their blood, sweat and toil. Right. Now, what am I saying here? I'm saying, and on one level, that there's a certain iteration of capitalism in this current moment that is in profound crisis, and all of its contradictions are in full view. We have been living under the last 40, 50 years, whether you call it Reaganism, Thatcherism, neoliberalism, however you describe it. We've been dealing with a political, an economic philosophy that carries with it a political rationality, Sam, and that is that it has transformed us from people in community with each other to individuals in pursuit of their own self-interest in competition and rivalry with others. So the idea of a robust public good has been completely eviscerated in the name of the radical pursuit of one's own self-interest, so much so that you can't even get people to put on damn masks right. because they're so concerned about their liberty and self-interest. Those things, to me, oftentimes work as synonyms, right? Those two words. So part of what we see is that, the extraction of resources by the 1%, the top 1/10% in the name of these are the producers, the others are the takers, right? The evisceration of working class folk by in some ways putting up every kind of roadblock for them to organize, to demand more resources. So they're living hand to mouth. They're in a state of precarity, so it becomes very difficult for them to organize. And so they scapegoat, right? They find black and brown people. These are the reasons why we're catching hell, some of these white workers will say, because big government is intruding, like taking money from hardworking white folk and giving it to these undeserving black and brown folks. And so you get race as the wedge issue race as overdetermining the way in which capital moves because these particular bodies are viewed as disposable. Does that make sense, or am I just running my mouth?
No. That does make sense, and I guess I mean that relationship between race and capitalism, particularly as it's practiced in this country, but that race has become, or the race was an easier way of exploiting a certain class of making sure that you had, you know, an exploitable class, and that poor people, working class people were also more easily exploitable. It helped to reinforce both. I mean, I feel like they were self-reinforcing on some level.
Exactly. Stuart Hall, the late cultural theorist out of Britain, used to say, and I don't think this holds true in all cases, but he used to say that race is the modality through which class is experienced in the United States. So whiteness is overdetermining so much in the country. Yeah.
So with that said, like, is there a danger to return to that metaphor analogy, I guess, that you made between the statues and the Chicago highway? I'm not familiar specifically with that part of Chicago, but the idea of statues that are homages to racism, essentially, and infrastructure which are on a symbolic level could be seen as an homage to racism, but are in fact, you know, sort of actively, they were constructed and function in a racist, at least a white supremacist manner. And if folks can go back and listen to our talks in the past so they can, you know, sort of really appreciate white supremacy as a function of perceiving white people as more valuable and more important and first in line and et cetera, as opposed to, you know, we're burning a cross on somebody's front lawn.
Yeah.
But like, you know, like, is there a problem in the competition for a limited amount? In other words, like, you know, is there a problem with having that outlet, that altruistic outlet, that philanthropic outlet, as you referred to it, when that can allow people to self-satisfy? I mean, I remember a moment early on in my radio career, Naomi Klein came into studio, and she had come back from Davos, and she expressed an anger about, I can't even remember who it was, some celebrity who had got up in the middle of a meeting and said, you know, if everybody here gave $10,000, we could get rid of malaria because we could provide nets. And everybody did it. And all of these other organizations were like, are you kidding me? You just let off these billionaires with a $10,000 check. And now they're walking away thinking, we cured malaria. That's great. We did our job there. Like, that to me is analogous to the statues on some level. We've gotten rid of the statue.
Go ahead.
Is that a problem? Are we letting too much air out of the tire with the statues?
It's a danger. It's just, you know, it's just like the analogy that we could make. You know, you think that just by recycling, you help in the right, you know, climate change, right? If only we all recycled, the world would be better. And we know that that's not true, right? We know that that's just simply not true. But we do know that the fact that we recycle has certain kinds of effects on our dispositions, on how we orient ourselves to the world. So it makes sense that I'm attentive to the matter of plastics in my house. It makes sense that I want to recycle paper. Right. It's not going to solve the problem, but it certainly orients me differently to the world. At least it ought to. Now, I think you're right. When we approach these issues as kind of charitable enterprises, right, then we're content with tinkering around the edges. We're content with symbolic gestures. Right. You know, it's like Mario Cuomo said to the protesters, you got what you want. Go on home now. And you just kind of go, what the hell? Right. There's a sense in which you get these kind of tinkering around the edges with reform, And that's the, that becomes the answer. And now people want to pat themselves on the back and then they expect gratitude. So I don't want to think about them in opposition because it matters. As a kid growing up in Mississippi, Sam, I found myself celebrating Stonewall Jackson.
Right.
As a black kid, that makes no damn sense. You know, students at Princeton going into Wilson, you know, Wilson Hall, you know, living in Wilson Residential College, knowing that this guy didn't want them there. It matters. The symbolic landscape matters, but it's not sufficient. It's necessary, but it's not a sufficient response to the reality that we're experiencing. So I don't want to see them as oppositional. I don't want to see them as sequential either. What I want to see them as is a necessary component to the fundamental transformation and re-envisioning of who we are as Americans and who this country takes itself to be. Does that make sense?
Yes. So what, how much, like, what is your sense of what happens when Biden's elected, right? I mean, because I remember vividly the night that Bill Clinton was elected and everybody was so excited because the Reagan era was over and then everybody just went to sleep. And on some level, you know, I think with it was a little bit less so because of the crisis, but also I think part of it was that Obama had and his campaign had set things up where there wasn't a lot of infrastructure left when they got to office, and they had set that up in many respects, outside infrastructure. They had set that up, political infrastructure. They had set that up almost deliberately. But there was a quality of, like, people are going to sleep now because, thank God, George Bush is not there anymore. What happens? What's your sense of what happens with Joe Biden? Like, where are we going to be in February of next year, assuming that Joe Biden wins? If Trump wins, we can reconvene to discuss. But
buckle up.
Yeah.
Buckle up. Because first of all, if Biden wins the 40%, the 38%, or however number you want, whatever that number is, that our ardent Trump supporters are going to lose their damn minds. That's the first thing. So we're going to have to deal with in January, Sam, we will be facing as a country the first disruption of the peaceful transfer of power. I think that's the first thing we need to understand. The second thing, I don't think we've fallen for that okie doke before. Remember, I wrote in Democracy in Black that people green screened President Obama, that he became the object of a lot of organizing. Oftentimes, because Americans, we often don't have a memory, we forget that, you know, Obama stepped in front of massive anti-war protests. There was organizing on the ground against the Iraq war, organizing on the ground for living wage, organizing on the ground around policing, all of this. And Obama became the object of that organizing. And Bob Moses told me a long time ago that when political campaigns become the object of organizing, that organizing can easily be demobilized by, yes, victory or defeat. So, and then once Obama was elected, folks went quiet and then they had to reconstitute themselves. And then we got occupied. Then we got Black Lives Matter, right? We got that energy back. So I don't think Biden is going to demobilize anything.
He hasn't
either. We've fallen for that okey-doke before. What'd you say? I'm sorry.
Well, he hasn't mobilized, right? Like, I mean, it's Donald Trump has been the figure of mobilization, to the extent that there are people coming out to vote. I think there is an incredible enthusiasm to vote for Biden, but because his name is not Trump.
Right. And I think that enthusiasm will translate post January, after the November election, into pressing his administration, right, to engage in bold action. Because I think that my hope is that this election not only will Trump be put out of office, but the Senate will flip. And then the Democratic Party will be on the hot seat. And if the corporate wing of that party insists on going back to normal, going back to what was, and when you ask what was, right, you had enormous wealth inequality, you had police brutality, you had workers barely making ends meet, student loan debt surpassing credit card debt, right? Folk can't afford college. I mean, we can just delineate what right. was normal, and what was normal was broken. So if there is this move to go back to normal, then we're going to see, I think, even more organizing, mobilizing, protest. It's going to be a very interesting time in the country. Buckle up.
Okay. And so lastly, let me ask you this. With all of that said, revisiting Baldwin today, what will that do for folks?
Baldwin had to come to terms with the fact that the country turned its back on the Black freedom struggle. He had to pick up the pieces. He had to deal with his own despair and disillusionment. He saw that the country had elected Ronald Reagan, Sam. And for Black activists, we often don't understand this. For Black activists, Ronald Reagan was as bad as George Wallace.
Right.
Right. He was the governor of California with the repression of the Panther Party, with the pursuit of Angela Davis. He was the benign George Wallace, the charming version of white supremacy, right? And Baldwin says he knew why they voted for him. It was a justification of their whiteness, quote unquote. So part of what I want us to do is to see that Baldwin bore witness to a moment in which the country turned its back on its promise, on its ideals. And what he insisted upon is that we bear witness and we continue to fight for the New Jerusalem by telling the truth, right? So what does it mean to turn to him in this moment? What does it mean to think with him in this moment, right? We need to find the energy, muster the courage, right, to step out and risk everything right now, right here, because the country faces a moral reckoning. And if we choose to double down on our ugliness again, I fear that we may not survive this time.
Professor Eddie Gloud, the book is Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lesson for Our Own. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure. I really appreciate it and appreciate your work, of course, over these years. And I'm glad we have you.
Man, thank you so much for what you do, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about this book. I appreciate you.